This is continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh from True Crime Today.
Welcome back to our continuing coverage. I'm Tony Bruschi. Let's head back to the courtroom for segment number two of coverage.
Jury is present, sir.
Sir, thank you. You may proceed.
May I please court, Your Honor?
Yes, sir.
All right. I think when we left off, I was showing you states, what is that, 313, I believe? And that's
313.
That's the Ferris check that was found in the defendant's office that he had lied to everyone and told that he never received.
This is the first one.
One of them, at least, correct?
One of them, the first one that we knew of.
All right. And then we're around September 2nd or something like that, and around that same time, Jeannie starts researching in y'all's system, Forge, and then finds all the fake Forge checks. Is that right?
She used the query Forge to see whether anything had been put into an annuity, any fees had been moved or put under an annuity, and a list came out of, I don't know, 10 or 12 different cases.
And y'all called the real Forge and said, y'all have any of these clients? And they said no. Y'all ever banked to Bank of America? They said no.
We did, but in that list, like the fourth or fifth one was a client that I was representing, and the money was to be held in trust. And when we pulled up the documents, supporting documents, it had a notation on it that it was invested for 3 years, which I knew couldn't be, so I went and called the client. Client verified that he hadn't authorized anything, hadn't done anything, and I immediately told him that his funds would be put back in there, and I walked back across the street to Jeannie's office and told him we had a big problem.
And that was Thomas Moore, correct?
That was Tommy Moore, yeah.
That was a highway patrolman who had been injured, correct?
Correct.
And Alex stole his money?
He did.
And they had been friends, to your knowledge?
As far as acquaintances, friends, I'm not sure what their relationship.
And I'm not going to go through in great detail because it's already been done, but generally you and Jeannie were probably the main drivers of the investigation into all of this theft in States 314, this spreadsheet.
All of us were involved, but I was with Jeannie a vast amount of the time.
I'm sorry?
I was with her a vast amount of the time, going through and auditing them and checking to see.
All right. And ultimately, you had to reach out and talk to a lot of these clients of Alec Murdaugh's, right?
I did.
And you had to tell them what had happened?
I did, including 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, another one.
And you had to tell them that Alec had lied to them, right?
I did.
And they said, Alec lied to me. He never told me that, correct?
Yeah.
Response?
I'll move on. You had conversations with all those clients, the clients that you dealt with, right?
I dealt with the majority of them, yes.
All right. I'm going to show you what's been marked as Exhibit 314. Just real quick, go through and just don't have to go into anything more, but just list the names of people that you had to deal with personally over what he had done.
Well, I was involved with the one for Barrett Bowler with Ronnie.
All right, let's talk about Barrett for a second. That was one of his close friends, right?
He was.
And can you describe the money that he stole from Barrett?
Barrett had a fire on a piece of property that he had, and it burned down the house. And there were proceeds for cleaning up, and then there were proceeds for various and sundry things that were associated, as well as the structure. And we started looking at it and figured out that the $75,000 had been stolen. And then later on that there was an additional amount that never went through there.
How much was that additional amount?
$279,000, according to this exhibit number.
That was a close friend of his, correct?
I would say that was one of his closest friends.
One of his closest friends.
That's who he ended up getting Moselle from.
And when he stole that $75,000 from Barrett Bowler, Barrett was sick and needed that money to put his wife up in a hotel near the hospital he was at, didn't he?
Barrett was dying of colon cancer, yes.
And needed that money, and Alex stole it anyway, right?
I assume he needed the money.
All right, keep going. Just again.
The next one down is Jacob, the estate of Jacob Hershberger. And at first,
again, we don't need to get into each one, but that's one of them that you had to deal with.
That's one that I just dealt with 2 weeks ago, and we're still straightening it out.
But you had the firm had to straighten it out and deal with the money because he took it, correct?
We are now. We're in the process of it.
After talking with the clients and everybody else involved, right?
Correct.
All right, go on to the next one, please.
Mr. You want me to give the names or?
Yeah, just give
Mr.
Names.
Anderson, I dealt with. Dion Martin, and his family, I dealt with.
All right, let me slow you down. So Christopher Anderson, you said, that's somebody you had to talk to yourself?
Yes, sir.
And the firm had to pay money for what he did, correct?
Yes, sir.
Dion Martin, was somebody you talked to yourself?
I did, and along with his parents.
Been horribly injured in an accident?
He had a brain injury, correct.
And had a brain injury?
Yes, sir.
And you had to talk to him about the defendant lying to him with his brain injury, correct?
And his parents.
And his parents, and taking his money, correct?
Correct.
All right, keep going.
Elise Mallory.
Elise Mallory, and she had a relative who died, correct?
She did, and I had represented.
Very sweet old lady. Have you met her?
Well, Elise.
That's what I mean.
She's not real.
Oh, I'm sorry. The person that you dealt with, the personal representative.
And then.
Is she a very sweet, nice lady? The PR?
Yeah.
In that case?
I haven't had a single one of these clients that weren't nice people.
Very nice people.
Super nice people. And
he took advantage of each one of them and lied to them, correct?
Yes, sir.
All right. Tell me some more names.
The Risher case, I wasn't involved in it. Johnny Bush, I dealt with him. I talked with J.J. Jinks.
To your knowledge, Johnny Bush considered himself a friend of Alec Murdoch's?
I don't know whether they were friends, but they were good acquaintances. Johnny was a little bit different. He had overcharged him or gave him the impression that it was the $95,000 was for expenses, and it was not.
So he lied and told him that there were expenses that had to be paid, and instead Alec Murdoch stole that money from his good acquaintance, Johnny Bush, correct?
That's correct.
Keep going.
J.J. Jinks, I talked with J.J., but I didn't deal with the paying him back part of it.
But y'all, the firm still had to pay him back for the lies that Alec Murdoch told, correct? And for the theft.
Correct.
All right, keep going if you would, please.
The Christiani matter is still ongoing.
All right, keep going if you would, please.
And then Randy Draughty, that matter's over. Tommy Moore, I've dealt with him. His money's back in trust where it's supposed to be.
Right. Tommy Moore was a highway patrolman that got injured in the line of duty, correct?
He was.
And Alec lied to him and took his money, correct?
Correct. This is not all of them either.
So that's the ones for now, correct? That's the ones that are on that list that's been admitted to evidence here, correct?
Correct, but there's a good many more than this.
Conversations with the defendant that back around the time of the recession that he had gotten into some land deals that had gotten him some financial issues.
I think it was squeezing him, yes.
And then not long after that, he had some big cases such as the Arthur Badger case and the Pinckney UPS case and the Plyler case in which he got a large amount of fees from very large recoveries, correct?
Badger was the UPS. Pinckney was a tire case.
Okay.
But yeah, he got very big fees.
All right. And you thought that with all those fees that you knew who he got because he's your partner and you get to see the books. You're the treasurer of the firm or have been for an extended period. Is that correct?
For the old firm, yes.
And you thought that the money that he legitimately got from those cases had solved those problems because it was a lot, wasn't it?
I think I, along with everybody else, thought that he was totally out of any debt.
But on top, but you've come to find out on top of the fees that he got, he also stole millions from those clients, correct?
Yes, sir.
It wasn't enough for him, was it?
Clearly not.
I'm almost done. Going back to that scene that you went to, you didn't see any blood on Alec Murdoch that night, did you?
No, sir.
And when you went back the next day, you went back because y'all had attempted to call, y'all had called the coroner to get the names, and he had given you the names of some companies that their job is to come out and help clean up scenes like this, correct?
That's correct.
And y'all had called them, but nobody called back, and you just felt like you had to do something, so you went to the scene. Is that right?
Well, we were trying to also see what we could find out, if there was anything that we could do to lend assistance. I mean, this was something that was, I mean, everything stopped.
Everything stopped.
The whole world did.
And being a friend like people would be and just trying to do whatever you could, correct? Well,
friend and, we're lawyers. We try to figure out what happened to things.
And you went in that feed room and observed the things that you saw.
I did.
And you also ended up getting blood on your sleeves, correct?
I did. I didn't know.
Up high, correct?
On my shoulder areas and on my pants.
I asked you a little bit about the defendant's cell phone use. Was it like him to have very short phone calls, or was he one to talk for a while?
I mean, he would cut you off with one phone call coming in on top of another. He'd call you about something and say, "Oh, I'll call you back," and click it off, and you know.
But he'd start talking about something, right?
Yeah, but I mean, he would. It was regular.
It was regular. He would typically talk for more than a minute, though.
I would assume so. I mean, most people, a minute is not much of a conversation.
It's not much of a conversation just for a minute, is it?
No.
The night of the murders, did you see a golf cart up at the Moselle residence?
I saw one in front of their house.
In front of the house?
Yeah, if you drove up the driveway, it was over to the left.
It was parked in front of the house?
It was parked off to the left side of the house.
Going back to September, and y'all find out about the Ferris fees, and y'all find out about Fake Forge, and y'all have a meeting of partners without Alec there and without Randy there, correct?
Well, first of all, on the 2nd, which was Thursday,
right,
when the stuff with Forge came up and you started looking down, when I made the phone call to Tommy Moore, right, and first thing Jeannie did was start grabbing our check. All we could see was our end of it. So if a check was written off of our trust account or our operating account, but these were mostly trust checks, if it was written off of the trust account, we could get a copy of our check. We didn't know where it had gone from there, and we could see the disbursement sheets, and we could tell where they were deposited by looking at the back of the check, which you don't normally do. I mean, it's just not. And when you started seeing commonality to it, and then, but the more thing was concrete. I mean, there was just no way that money couldn't have been written out, because it was being held. He had an ongoing workers' comp claim that was a statutory lien. You couldn't give him the money.
And bottom line is, without rehashing the whole story for the jury again, y'all knew he had been stealing at that point.
That's when we found out, and then I met.
Didn't know how much. In fact, you found out a whole lot later, correct?
A whole lot. We had about 6 at that time. I met with our president that night and Ronnie Crosby and set up a meeting for the next morning, and we met, and then Randy was tied up and then came, and at that point it was unanimous. And then Randy and Danny went and talked to him.
Right. And then when confronted,
he admitted
with that, and he was forced to resign, is that correct? Or y'all terminated him?
Well, he could either resign or be terminated, but it was a 30-second decision.
And what day was that when that happened?
That was Friday.
What day? Do you remember?
That would have been September the 3rd. And we immediately started into all the things you have to do when you find out that a lawyer's been stealing in your firm, which has been absolute teetotal pure hell since then.
So everything was coming home to roost. The storm was arriving again for Alec on September 3rd when y'all confronted him. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. I mean, it was over.
And then on September 4th, what happened? What did you hear about?
I had spoken to Mr. Griffin just to let him know that we had terminated him. He already knew. And about 11:30, 12 o'clock, whatever time it was, I was on a tractor. And he called me and said, "You're not going to believe what happened." And I thought, my first response was, "Don't tell me that jackass killed himself."
Right.
And he said, "No, somebody shot him." And I just said, "I don't believe that."
You don't believe that. A lot of people thought right away, that, "Oh my gosh, the real killers are back." Correct? The chickens were home to roost again for Alec, and all of a sudden he's a victim again, correct?
Objection, Your Honor, what other people think.
Objection's overruled.
I went to the scene. I went straight to the scene. But I didn't believe it.
You didn't believe it?
No.
Because you have training as a lawyer, right?
I don't know whether it was intuition, training, whatever. I just didn't believe it.
And what did you see at the scene that confirmed time?
I got out.
It didn't work.
Danny and Ronnie were there and standing there, and I said, I don't buy it. And we walked up towards the car, and I think I said, "It's got run flat tires, and the tire's not flat." Before we got to it, Ronnie said, "It doesn't even have a spare." And then when we got up to it, you could see at 9 o'clock where somebody had stabbed the tire. And we hung around there, and then when Sled showed up, I think it was actually David Owens showed up or Ryan Kelly showed up, one of them, and that's when we told him we had fired him the day before. And what had happened, we were in consultation with a lawyer we had to hire on Friday to figure out what to do and how to do it. And when this happened, we thought they needed to know.
And you were told that Alec claimed at the scene that he was shot by some unknown assailant, correct?
That was the story.
But you knew this scene had been manufactured by Alec, correct, when you arrived there?
I didn't know that. I suspected. It just didn't look like, I mean, it was a shiny Mercedes black car with no holes in it, a single shot. The back hatch didn't open. There's no nothing. I mean, it just doesn't look right.
And just when accountability is arriving again, the defendant manufactures himself being a victim, correct?
That's what it turned out to be.
Thank you, Mr. Ball.
Redirect.
Briefly, Your Honor.
To your knowledge, has the law firm, PMPED, repaid all the money to the clients that's owed, as well as insurance company have pitched in?
To this point, we still have, we're holding some money as of 2 weeks ago, and in one of the matters, we're trying to get that money returned. We're having to go through a PR. Okay.
And the list of names that you read off, those folks, if they're entitled to the money now, they've received it? Is that right?
The people on that list have, yes, and there's plenty, a bunch more that have as well.
And the law firm is currently out a lot of money. Is that correct?
We are.
As a result of Alex?
Well, the law firm and the partners in the law firm.
Yeah.
We've had to pony it out of our pocket.
Sure. You personally have had to pony up.
Yes, sir, along with my partners.
And when Alec was resigned or terminated in September, he had some cash flow coming into the firm that the firm was able to keep and use that to pay some of the clients.
No, sir. All of our funds, doesn't matter what I earn until it's declared at the end of the year. It's law firm money.
No, I understand that. So law firm money earned off Alex cases that was the firm money when he left?
Well,
we're talking a couple of million dollars?
First of all the cases are owned by the law firm. They're not Mark's cases. They're not Alex's cases. They're law firm cases. Cases that Alec was working on generated monies, and we internally decided how we were a formula that we were going to use, because people had to complete those cases, and we've allocated much more than ordinarily. Our expenses are taken out in a different way, but we allocated a bunch of money to paying those. Yes,
I understand. But the income from those cases, north of $2 million, perhaps?
Yes, sir.
And your firm and Jeannie Seckinger and others have cooperated with SLED and the Attorney General's office in their investigation of Alex misdeeds in relation to those client matters, have they not?
We have.
And as a result of, I mean, you're aware that Alex has 90 plus pending charges against him for financial, the stuff you just testified about, right?
Yes, sir.
And you've been subpoenaed here today to testify in the murder case, correct?
I've been subpoenaed since this trial started.
And you know this is the murder case?
Yes, sir.
Now, immediately after the murder of Maggie and Paul, and you talked about Alex's demeanor, did he come to work and was able to work on cases?
No, sir. He was out for a while. I think he went to his in-laws and stayed. He didn't. After the funeral was either Friday or Saturday, I can't remember. And then Randolph died on Thursday after this. And then Randolph's was on Sunday. And Alec he was staying between Randy, John Marvin, and whoever else, his mother's house. I think he went to his in-laws. I know he went down to visit with his brother-in-law and sister-in-law.
Sure. And
but no, he was not. There was a period of time he wasn't doing it. He might come by, and he would be in his office generally looking at sympathy notes.
And from your observation, was he in any frame of mind to do any productive legal work the month of June?
No.
The month of July?
We sat down and talked about it as partners, and not with Alec, about what we were going to do, because there's deadlines and things that have to be done, and so we were going to try to figure out how we were going to delicately kind of start stepping in on some of his cases and making sure everything was being done according to what needed to be.
And I think you testified about how the firm, partners in the firm, lawyers in the firms, were reaching out and using your resources to try to find out perhaps who played a role in killing Maggie and Paul.
We absolutely were.
But were you careful not to go out and do the investigation yourself and just relay the information back to SLED?
Right. I mean, we weren't trying to be private eyes or any of that. We were just trying to see, and I relayed numerous things to the various officers, and I would preface it by, I don't know whether this means anything, but you never know. I mean.
And was, to your knowledge, was information being relayed through Alex's attorneys to pass on to SLED?
Well, I know I dealt with you on various things up until the stealing.
Sure. And to your knowledge, was Alex consenting and cooperating with SLED in their investigation?
As far as I knew, yes. I mean, I wasn't with him during those interviews or anything else, but as far as I knew, he was. And I would ask him, you know, where we stand, you know, have you heard anything?
Right.
You know.
And were you aware that Alec Buster put up a reward?
I was.
And are you also aware that when Paul was criminally charged in the boating case, Alec came under criticism for interfering in the investigation. You remember that?
I was.
And in fact, there's been some pretty public allegations about that, about Alec, that were had surfaced before Maggie and Paul had been murdered.
Absolutely. I mean, they were criticizing him for advising people of stuff, but I'm a lawyer, I'm a parent, daddy. One of my kids has some problem or gets accused of something, or one of my friend's kids, I'm going to put my lawyer hat on and advise them to be quiet until their parents get there and get counsel if I think it's a serious matter.
Sure. You were asked about Alec's cell phone use and about whether he would take the phone down to the kennel. Have you ever been down to the kennels with Alec?
Yeah.
Okay. Have you been riding the property with Moselle with Alex?
I have, not a whole lot. I mean, as time went on, you know, our families got older, and you just, when you don't have children, it's you're doing a lot more things together on the weekends and stuff. And as your children get older and they're in college, and he was going to Walford and different places where Buster was, and
sure,
you know, your interests are different as well. But yeah, I would occasionally, or if he was building something, he might ask me what I thought about it or show me something. I mean, I saw his duck pond and, you know, rode around the property several times.
Was cell phone coverage spotty down at the shed in the kennels?
It can be. It varies. I mean, it can be. I don't remember specifically where and what. You know, out where I live, if I go in my house with a metal roof, this morning somebody was trying to talk to me and I had to walk out on the porch. Other days I can talk just fine in my house. I live 8 miles, 9 miles from where this place is, and I don't know whether it's a metal roof or whether I'm just at the end of wherever a cell tower is, but out in my area, which is Rum Gully,
sure,
it can be spotty.
And you mentioned about spending time at Moselle and when the kids were younger, that before Alec got Moselle, you had a farm.
I do.
And would Alec bring the boys over to hunt on your property?
Mostly Paul. Yeah, I mean, Buster would come some, but Buster was older, and then obviously when Buster started college, he wasn't around as much. But Paul was a very avid hunter and was over either my place or Ronnie's place a lot.
And he and Alec were together a lot doing that?
Paul?
Were he and Alec, I mean, excuse me, he and Paul? Alec and Paul together a lot.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And Paul was with his grandfather a lot.
And I think you mentioned that Paul would leave stuff over there?
All three of them, but, you know, they would just... They'd leave a gun, they'd leave a coat, they'd leave a flashlight, maybe all three. And it was just sort of a running joke that you had to kind of go around and gather up their stuff after they left. And that was just them.
And did you remember one time Paul left a gun over there for a couple of months?
He did. And Alec left one time, I believe. And I cleaned it and put it up, and he started asking around where his gun was, and you know, we just sort of played with him a little bit and then gave it back to him.
Right. I think you testified moving from September the 4th. You had gotten word about a shooting involving Alec, and I think your words were that jackass had killed himself.
That was what I thought immediately.
And why did you think that?
Because of all that had gone on. We had terminated him, or he had resigned the day before. This financial stuff was starting to come out. And, you know, I thought, you know, he'd lost two family members and now he's got no job. And, you know, it seemed feasible. I mean, I had been concerned about him, his mental health, from the time of the murders up until then. In fact, I had suggested that he go see somebody for grief counseling, I mean, we were all grieving their loss. And you know, it's one of those deals that you just, you can tell when somebody's not hitting on all cylinders, and he obviously was. I would come by his office and he would be crying. I mean, or I would ask him something. I remember him asking me one time when he was going through his, he had a stack of sympathy cards, and he said, should I send them all back a note? And I said, Alec, people don't send you sympathy cards right. to, you know, get a note back from you. There's no way in the world you can do that.
And he was,
he said
when
he missed
he was terminated from the firm and you were concerned about perhaps what he might do, did you ever think maybe he'll go kill a family member? Did that ever cross your mind?
No. You talking about when we terminated him?
Yes, sir.
By then, Maggie and Paul had been killed.
Well, he had family out there.
He did. I never thought of any of that. Listen, when September the 2nd hit, it changed everything that I knew about Alec. I would have never believed that a guy that, you know, was like family would have ever stolen from me, would have stolen from his family, would have stolen from his clients, or any of that. And so immediately, you've got this rage, this emotion that you've got. And then on the 3rd, we go through this whole ordeal of the termination, and then the 4th it hits, and you're like, you know, did the jackass kill himself because of anything else? And then as time progressed on and you see the scope of it, I mean, I don't know the guy that after September the 3rd and leading out, I don't know who that guy is. I mean, that's not Alec that I knew.
Right.
And Alec that I loved, and Alec that all of us loved. You know, did he have imperfections? You bet. Did he do things that aggravated the hell out of me? You bet. But you don't kick your brother out the door because, you know, they snore at night or you know, they've done things that aggravate you. You get past it. But when they do things that are criminal and they do things that affect not only him, but he's torn down an entire legacy, a law firm. I've spent 34 years, or 33 years, I guess, in this one place. It's the only law firm that I've ever worked at. I put everything in it. It's all my children have known, my family's known, and it's gone. We had to change the name. We've had to do all these things because of his acts on this financial stuff. Right. And when it comes to that, I'm mad as hell. I mean, you just don't know how mad I am. But on the other hand, I'm not saying that because he did that, he's done what he's accused of. And so that's, you know, that's sort of the bottom line of it. His actions that, I mean, he was doing that way back, but we never knew it.
Sure.
And when we found out about it, it makes you doubt everything, and it's just human nature. But I don't have one shred of anything. All I can do is just point to what I saw.
And you pointed to the roadside shooting and what you saw. You thought that jackass tried to kill himself.
Absolutely, and I may not have said jackass, but that's about as
non-church as I want to get. To you, it made sense why he would want to kill himself in that moment.
Sure. I mean, he lost, as far as I was concerned, he'd lost everything. He'd lost his job, and he'd lost, forget the job, forget the money, forget what's going to happen to him. He'd lost his wife and his child. And
are you aware that he had $12 million of life insurance?
I didn't know what he had. I assumed he had some life insurance, but no. I mean, I never had that conversation with him, and I, quite frankly, I'd have to see it to really believe it.
Okay. Thank you. That's all the questions.
Recross.
I think you just said that what you know now about this man who'd been your partner and friend for 34 years causes you to question everything you thought you knew about him. Isn't that right?
It does.
You were asked about all those clients that had to be repaid money, and none of that money came from him, did it?
No, sir.
Y'all had to pay that money, right?
We did.
How much?
I would say, at this point, probably north of $10 or $11 million. Now, insurance paid for some of that, but I mean, there's been a substantial chunk of that that came out of our pocket.
You were asked about Alec having some cases that were coming in, but you explained, though, that this is June, and that disbursement's not going to come to him until December. He's not going to be able to get that money until December, correct? Any of what he's entitled to, which isn't all of it, correct? Because it belongs to the firm.
Right. Everything belongs to the firm until the end of the year when you meet, and then you divide up money and...
And that's why he stole the Ferris fees in March, because he needed the money right then.
I would assume so. I mean, the money was gone, and it was paid in three checks.
You said that in the month after the murders, he wasn't really working on cases, but he sure managed to arrange to cover those Ferris fees to pay him back so that everyone would forget about it, didn't he? Or not all of it. He managed to do that, didn't he?
Yeah, well, part of it. I mean, I think there was $192,000 that didn't...
That he convinced Chris Wilson to cover for it.
Convinced, or Chris had to cover it, one of the two.
You were asked about him cooperating with law enforcement in the murders. But he never told law enforcement that he was down at the kennels just minutes with the victims before they died. He never told law enforcement that, did he?
Yeah, I did.
I think it's responsive to redirecting them.
You can testify if you know.
I don't know what he told law enforcement other than what's been out there in the public.
Well, let me ask you this. He denied to you three times that he ever went to those kennels, did he not?
He did.
His buddy, his friend, and his law partner, 34 years, told you three times, I was never there.
That's correct.
And you know now that's a lie.
When I saw the video a month or so ago.
Thank you, Mr. Ball.
You step down.
Thank you.
Let me call your next witness.
Your Honor, the defense calls Dawes Cook. Dawes Cook.
Dawes Cook.
Exhibit, place your left hand on the Bible and raise your right. You swear the testimony that you give today will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
I do.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
We have a seat up on the witness stand. And please pull that microphone to you and adjust it so that it's your height and you can talk into it. You'll state your name and spell your last name.
Morris Dawes Cook, Jr., and Cook is C-O-O-K-E.
Thank you. Would you please tell the jury a little bit about yourself?
I'm a lawyer. I practice in Charleston, South Carolina with firm Barnwell Whaley, Patterson & Helms. I've been doing it since graduated from law school in 1979, clerked for a judge for a year, and I've been with the same law firm since 1980. And I practice mainly civil litigation.
And do you primarily represent plaintiffs or defendants?
I don't mind representing plaintiffs, but most of the time I'm representing defendants.
All right. And do you know Alex Murdaugh?
I do.
How do you know him?
Through practice of law. I've had cases against him over the years.
Okay. And have you represented him before?
No. Well, now I do, but I did not previously
right.
to this. Right.
Right. What was the scope of your representation?
I'm defending him in the boat accident case.
Okay. And when were you asked to join his team?
In December of 2020, I got a call from Danny Henderson and asked me if I would become involved. The case was already had already been going on for a year and a half or so at that time.
Okay. And did he have other attorneys representing him at that time?
Yes. Yeah, the Haynesworth firm, John Tiller in particular, was representing him.
Okay. And what, if any, understanding do you have as to why you were asked to join the defense team?
Well, John was sick, as I think everybody knows now, and would be undergoing treatment from time to time, and he was unsure as to whether he'd be able to cover everything by himself. And so I was asked, one, to help him, sort of be a second chair for him, and also be a backup for times when he would not be able to participate.
Okay. And would you please describe for the jury your assessment of the merits of the claim against Alex in June of 2021?
Well, I think I was the one that coined the phrase negligent parenting that Mark mentioned during his testimony. The claim at that time was that Alec was responsible for the boat accident because he knew that Paul was using his brother's ID. And I mean, I didn't think that there was a claim in South Carolina law for that, so I sort of facetiously called it negligent parenting. So we felt that it was a defensible claim. I always sort of felt that lurking out there was going to be the what's now negligent entrustment, that eventually they would allege negligence for having let him use the boat, which is the substance of the claim now. But even that, we always felt like it was a defensible claim. That you know, I think the big picture that occurred to me was to hold him liable for that would be to hold him to a higher standard than any of the other parents of the other folks that were in the boat, which
okay.
Anybody who's raised kids knows that that can be difficult.
Okay. And what was your assessment as to Alex's financial exposure as a result of this case in June of 2021?
Well, it was unknown, and I'll have to say that was I didn't even really pay attention to that issue at the time. I think there was still a declaratory judgment action pending that was going to decide whether there was some additional insurance. I knew that the one policy was relatively limited. So I wouldn't have said that he had no personal exposure, but that was certainly not the focus of our attention at that time.
Right. And were there motions pending when you joined the case?
Yes. Several motions pending. For some time, there had been a motion by Parkers to change venue. They wanted it out of Hampton and into Beaufort County. And there was also, they had made a motion to amend their answer to plead admiralty law, which would have some benefits over South Carolina law for the defense. And then there was this, there may have been some motions to compel discovery with Parkers. I don't really remember specifically, and I think in October of 2020, there had been a motion to compel the answers to interrogatories and motion and request to produce to Alec.
Okay. And have you reviewed that motion to compel?
Yes.
Okay. Plaintiff's exhibit, not plaintiff, I'm sorry, State's exhibit 402. Can you see that?
Yes.
Okay, great. And do you, this is just the first page, but do you recognize this as the motion?
That's the motion. Itself? And then okay. I think attached to that were two sets of interrogatories and a set of requests to produce.
All right. So I'm going to use the interrogatories. Would you just briefly explain to the jury what interrogatories and requests for production are?
Right. Well, we call it discovery. The rules of civil procedure provide various means of obtaining information from the other side. So interrogatories is questions that you can ask, and then requests to produce are documents and other materials that you can require be provided.
And the supplemental ones that we're looking at right here, were those seeking financial information, Mr. Murdoch?
Yes.
Okay. And the objections, if you'll, well, the answers right here to the interrogatories, and then the objection right here. Have you reviewed those?
Yes.
Okay. In your practice, are those common objections?
Right. That's this was done before I was involved in the case, but those are the exact objections that I would have made. These financial discovery, it's sort of the plaintiff's lawyer's way of saying I'm really serious, and I'll call it intimidation, not in a pejorative way, but it's meant to really worry the defendants, and it's very common. And the typical response from the defendant would be just like this, and that is, we object, it's not relevant, you haven't gotten a judgment against us, you don't need to know how much money we have unless and until you do get a judgment. The comeback to that is, well, your net worth could be relevant on punitive damages. If it goes to the jury, a jury could consider your wealth as a factor in awarding punitive damages. And so 95% of the time you work out some agreement to provide a financial statement, but I would never have produced all of these details at this stage of litigation as a defense lawyer.
Okay. After joining the defense team, did you have meetings or communications with other members of the defense team?
Yes, regularly. And I have to admit, there's a lot I didn't remember, so I've gone back and I've looked at my emails, my time records. And we defense lawyers, we measure our lives in tenth of an hour increments, and we have to write everything down. So it was helpful for me to go back and look through my time records as well as emails to see who all was included. But yes.
Okay. And was Alex often CC'd on the emails?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right. Did you ever participate in any Zoom meetings with the defense team?
Yes. The one I, well, there's more than one. But the first one I remember was April 15 of 2021. I was just sort of getting involved. I don't think I'd made a formal appearance in the case yet, but there was a Zoom conference. And I remember Alec was included on the Zoom invitation, but I honestly can't recall whether he was in the meeting itself. I remember others who were in the meeting.
Okay, and what was the purpose of that Zoom call?
It was really to kind of orient me, and also there were some motions scheduled in May, so it was just to get me oriented, talk about what the important issues in the case were and the things that we'd be focusing on.
Okay, and having attended that meeting, what, if any, understanding did you have as to the biggest issues facing Alex at the upcoming motions hearing?
Right, and I had to go back and look at my notes to refresh my memory on that, but it was the upcoming, as far as I was concerned, it was the venue issue, whether the case was going to be transferred back to Beaufort, because we didn't want it transferred back. We wanted it to stay in Hampton. We thought that the plaintiff wanted it to stay there too, but he was wavering, and there was some thought that he might consent, and we didn't want him to consent. So that was a big issue. And then we spent a lot of time talking about Admiralty. You know, was it beneficial to have Admiralty as opposed to state common law? So that was, as far as the hearing, that was the important part of the conversation. That was about a two-hour meeting, and we talked a lot about experts, depositions that needed to be taken, and so forth as well.
And after that meeting, based on those conversations, what, if any, understanding did you have as to the level of concern the defense team had regarding the motion to compel, the financial information?
I mean, really none. I wasn't dealing with Mark directly on that. John Tiller was doing it. And as far as we were concerned, that was something that they were going to work out. But the focus on the hearings was going to be on these other substantive issues.
Did you ever have a concern that the motion to compel would be granted in total?
What's the question?
Asked if he personally had expected the motion to compel to be granted.
Also 401 and 402.
I sustained the objection.
Okay. When was the motion to compel originally scheduled to be heard?
It was in May. I'm going to say May 10th, sometime in that area.
Okay. And did that go forward?
No, I think John, some of his treatment had to be rescheduled, and so they agreed to continue the hearing.
Okay. And when was it rescheduled for?
June. And I don't recall the exact date, but maybe the 10th or so.
Okay. And at any point prior to the motion to compel hearing that was scheduled, did anything change in terms of your understanding that would make you think the defense team was concerned about the motion to compel?
No, I filed my formal notice of appearance so that I could be at the hearing. I think I actually did that in May before the first hearing. And so I was prepared to be there to argue whatever needed to be argued. But as I go back and I look at my notes and my preparation, it was on the venue issue and the admiralty issue.
What, if any, factors did you consider when you made an assessment about Alex's personal financial exposure?
I mean, I never take a case lightly. I mean, Mark certainly is a, you know, very good lawyer, and obviously a very emotional case. So I won't say that we weren't concerned about it, but we knew that there had already been some other settlements, which we would have gotten credit for that. There were just a number of factors that made us feel like this was a defensible case and that it was not an existential threat to Alex.
Okay. Are you aware as to whether or not an order was eventually issued regarding the motion to compel?
Yes, what we call a Form 4 order was issued around October 7th or 8th of 2021.
Okay. What is your understanding of that order?
I've got it right here. Okay. I mean, it said that John Tiller had not been able to get the information and that, it says right here, the court at a hearing on plaintiff's motion to compel filed October 16, 2020 was informed that defendant's attorney Tiller, because of circumstances beyond his control, is unable to gather and provide the necessary information to answer the requested interrogatories at this time. Once this information is made available to attorney Tiller, the court will schedule a hearing on this motion to compel if necessary, which means that John Tiller was going to get the information, and then if he couldn't work it out with Mark, then they would have a hearing on the motion to compel.
So was it your understanding the court was ordering Alex to produce all of the financial information requested?
No, that's not what it said.
One or two more. Did you expect any cataclysmic event on June 10th regarding Alex having to give over financial documents?
No.
Okay. And do you recognize Mr. Tinsley? Do you know him?
Yep.
Do you see him here?
Yes.
Mr. Tinsley, can you stand up? Okay. Did you ever speak with him during the case?
Yes.
You did?
A number of times, yeah.
At all about the motion to compel?
No. Okay. Not that I remember. If he says I did, I couldn't deny it, but I don't remember it.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
By the state.
Like you said, the motion is meant to really worry the defendants, right? Those were your exact words, wasn't it?
Could you repeat that?
You just testified that the motion to get those financial information is meant to really worry the defendants. Those
right.
are your exact words, correct?
Always, yeah.
Okay. All right, and were you present at the trial lawyers conference when Alec Murdoch came up and towered over Mark Tinsley and said, "What's up, Bo? What are you doing?"
No,
were you present at that?
I don't get invited to that one.
Okay. I didn't think you did. But you weren't there when that happened, were you?
No.
You were present for when he did said that to that man right there about the boat case. What you doing, Bo? What's up?
Objection.
I was not there.
Basis for the objection.
Foundation.
The objection is overruled.
And you did not...
Said it wasn't there.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. All right. And you did not get... You didn't file your notice of appearance into this case until May of 2021, is that right?
I think that's about right, yeah.
Because you were actually representing other parties, and that had to be resolved before you could get involved with ELEC, is that correct?
That's part of the reason our firm was, yeah.
Right, so you couldn't have been, with the conflict, heavily involved in any discussions that were going on between Mark Tinsley and John Tiller and Amy Bauer prior to moving into May, is that right?
That wasn't exactly the reason. The conflict had been waived, but... I just wasn't involved in that. That was something John and Mark were handling.
Right. And when John, in May of 2021, asked for a continuance of that hearing on which the motion to compel the financial information was part of, he didn't offer you as any sort of backup because you weren't fully on the defense team at that point. Is that correct?
I think I had planned to notice my appearance before that hearing. And I can't recall whether I didn't do it because the case was continued, but I would have appeared at the hearing.
You were asked about insurance coverage, and you're talking about the Philadelphia policy, right? That there was a declaratory judgment.
Right,
action.
Right.
Right. And the defense team knew that they weren't going to have any obligation to cover ELEC in this, correct? I mean, it was very unlikely. In fact, it ultimately, Judge Sherry Lydon in the Federal District Court denied that Philadelphia had to cover ELEC one penny. Correct?
Yeah, I'll have to say I wasn't following that, but that's pretty much my understanding. It was a long shot that there would be coverage.
And when you were at this point in time in May of June of 2021, just getting on the defense team, you certainly didn't know anything about his true financial condition, did you?
No.
You didn't know he'd been stealing money for years and years, did you?
No.
You didn't know that he was broke, did you?
No.
You didn't know he had misappropriated funds and was scrambling to try to replace those before people found out, did you?
No.
You were asked about the hearing on June 10th that ultimately was continued because of these terrible murders, correct?
Correct.
That's your understanding. The murders happened and that hearing got continued because, of course, who's going to have a hearing in the wake of these terrible events, correct?
Yeah, I think Mark agreed to continue the hearing.
Of course. Right. Yeah, that guy got continued, right?
Right.
And even as a civil defense attorney, even if you believe that a claim down the line may be defensible, that still doesn't change the discovery process in a civil case that goes on, correct?
That's true.
I mean, discovery still can happen and is going to happen,
right,
regardless of whether or not the case settles or goes to trial or whatever happens, correct?
Yeah, it's still going on.
And that's how civil cases, typically how cases work in court, is that both parties have to share a lot of information, and if one party doesn't want to share it, the other party can ask the judge to order it, correct?
That's right.
All right, and that goes on regardless of whether or not the claim is ultimately going to be successful. That's part of the initial process.
Right.
All right. And that was on the table for June 10th. That was one of the things that was on the table, correct?
The financial?
Yes.
Yeah. And there was the other interrogatories, too.
And there was a number of other things as well.
Right.
All right. And if that hearing had gone forward, there could have been an order issued compelling that process, correct?
Could have been. Yeah.
All right. And so once that happened, once that order gets issued, that's going to set in motion a train that's going to have to come to a conclusion in a court of law, correct?
If that happened, right. Ultimately, the judge is going to decide what has to be produced and what doesn't.
Right? That's right. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Cook.
Thanks.
with you. Mr. Waters just asked you for your opinion as to the June 10th hearing, and based on your 40 years of experience, defending
cases. I did not ask for her for the opinion. I just asked what potentially could happen.
Let me hear the question.
Based on your 40 years of experience, what was your opinion of the likelihood that the order to compel would be granted?
Objection, Your Honor.
Let me ask you this. Just because it's possible that the order could have been granted, does that make it plausible?
Objection, Your Honor.
Sustained.
Okay. Yes. Judge had ordered the documents to be produced at the June 10th hearing, would Alec have had to turn them over immediately?
No.
That's all I have. Thank you.
Any further?
If that had happened, it would have set in a process, set in motion a process, though, would it not have?
You know,
let me rephrase that question.
If he'd ordered production of all of the documents that were requested?
Right.
Yeah. That would have been part of the process, right?
It would have started a process, an order of a judge, correct?
That's true, yeah.
It would have happened eventually if the judge had ordered that, correct?
If he ordered production of all the documents, right.
Nothing further, thank you.
I step down.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Our next witness.
Please, the court, Your Honor. The next witness is an expert. It's going to take a while. We can begin and break for lunch and then... I'm do whatever you want to do.
We'll go for about a half an hour, then break. Mr. Harpootling?
And Xerxes.
Do you swear or affirm that the testimony you give today will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Thank you, sir. Go ahead and have a seat, right, if you're on the witness stand.
Yes,
have a seat and adjust that microphone to where you can speak into it well. And if you would please state your name and spell your last name for us, please.
Yes, ma'am. Kenneth, last name Xerxes, Z like zebra, E-R-C-I-E. Good morning, Your Honor.
Mr. Xerxes.
Yes, sir.
Please tell the jury a little bit about yourself. Where do you live?
In Madison, Connecticut.
Okay. And what do you do in Madison, Connecticut?
Currently live with my wife, and my son lives up the street from us. Currently employed by the Henry Seeley Institute of Forensic Science at the University of New Haven. As the director of training. In addition to that, I'm also on staff at the university.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you very well. Maybe it's just me, but...
I'm also on staff at the university as an adjunct professor in various forensic science disciplines.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about your background. You've been involved in law enforcement in your life?
Yes, sir, I have.
Tell the jury, please, where you began.
In 1974, I became an officer with the New Haven Police Department, also in Connecticut. I was promoted to the rank of detective. Most of my career there, for my 11-year duration prior to retiring, was with the identification unit, responsible for crime scene processing, evidence collection, photography, and preliminary examination of physical evidence that's found at a crime scene. After that, I retired based on a disability. I was injured. And was almost immediately hired by the state of Connecticut at the Forensic Science Laboratory located in Meriden.
I'm sorry, and tell me what that was again. What was that position?
The second career, if you will, was at the Department of Public Safety, currently called the Division of Scientific Services Forensic Science Laboratory, originally brought in as a latent fingerprint analyst, also doing footworn tire track examination, as well as becoming the senior person as far as crime scene related activity that the laboratory would respond to assist investigative agencies. Over a 29-year career, I was promoted through the ranks and eventually retired as director of the laboratory.
And that's director of the Division of Scientific Services for the state of Connecticut?
Yes, sir.
And in your duties there, you indicated you started off not as a supervisor or as a supervisor?
Not as a supervisor, as a criminalist, right, with a specific function.
And a criminalist doing what kind of forensic work?
Starting primarily with fingerprints, latent fingerprint identification, and all the processing techniques involved. Because I had also experience doing footwear and tire track from the police department, I was given that task. And again, because of the crime scene background, also ended up as one of the senior people going to the major crime scenes when the laboratory services would be requested, and eventually ended up supervising the photography section because of that type of background as well.
So photography is important in processing a crime scene?
Absolutely.
Is that just for fingerprints or footprints or tire tracks or everything?
It involves the entire scene. It's the only way to bring the crime scene before a jury after the incident has occurred. Right, so it can be reviewed or
seen.
We're going
to talk about this a little bit later once I've had you qualified in these different areas. But and how long were you at the Division of Scientific Services?
For 29 years.
Right. Now, also, and you ultimately became the supervisor of that department for the state of Connecticut.
The director of the laboratory.
Okay, so you were there from July of 84 to October of 2012.
Yes, sir.
And what did you do after 2012?
I've been an adjunct professor at four different universities, off and on during that period, as well as approximately 20 to 25 years prior to retiring. I maintain that. I've also had a private consulting business that I've kind of let go by the wayside a little bit.
So what's the Henry C. Lee Institute of Forensic Science?
It's located at the University of New Haven. It's a separate entity under the university, and we're involved in doing scholarships, training and education, providing consultant work in cases, whether it's for the defense or the prosecution, but more to stay involved with the community and provide modern technologies.
Okay, and then you're the owner and principal analyst for Forensic Consultants of New England, LLC. What is that?
Again, that was the private business that I had on the side for doing consulting work.
Are you still doing that?
Technically, this case falls under that today.
Okay. Now, what's your educational background?
As far as criminal justice and forensic science, I have an associate's degree in criminal justice administration, a bachelor of science in what was called police science, basically a hybrid between administration and the forensic applications or sciences. And a master's of science in forensic science.
That's all from the University of New Haven.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Now, you have a resume with several pages of different teaching things you've done. I'm not going to go into those in detail. You have taught a number of courses. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Everything from footprints to bloodstains to tire tracks to crime scene supervision to, it just goes on and on and on and on. Have you ever been qualified to, by any court, to testify about fingerprint identification, that is, in a federal or state court in this country?
Yes, sir, I have.
And how many times?
Approximately 300.
300 times. And can you remember all the courts or several of the courts?
I can remember the states that they were in, but the specific ones, probably not.
Connecticut, I suppose.
Connecticut, Rhode Island, New York, Massachusetts, Florida.
That's enough. Okay, and how many times have you been qualified on footprints, or the more technical would be, what would you call that?
Footwear tire track examination or imprint analysis.
Imprint analysis.
How many times? Probably about 200.
300 times you've been qualified by state or federal court to be an expert on that topic.
About 200 as far as footwear and tire track.
Okay. Now, what about, and maybe I'm getting this term wrong, crime scene management or crime scene analysis? You've taught courses on that, correct?
I've taught and been an active participant at crime scenes, yes.
Okay. How many times have you been qualified, if you have, by federal or state court to testify on that topic?
Qualified, probably 400.
400 times?
Yes, sir.
And you've testified?
Yes, sir.
And this is both state and federal courts?
Yes, sir.
Your Honor, I would move to qualify him as an expert in fingerprint analysis, footprint analysis, tire print analysis, and crime scene analysis management. What, sir, tell me what the term is. Let me, I'm not screwing this up. Crime scene.
It would be crime scene examination as an overarching title.
There you go. Crime scene. Whatever he just said.
If he said it, I didn't hear it. How many times have you been qualified in tire impressions?
Approximately 200.
For tire impressions? No.
Tire and footwear.
No question.
He's so qualified.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now let's talk a little bit about, I have a PowerPoint here somewhere. I believe I sent y'all last night. Yeah. Can we call that up, please? You prepared a PowerPoint for your testimony here today? Sir, you have a PowerPoint? You
yes, sir.
Okay. Can we put that up on the screen, please?
Can you raise your voice any, sir?
I can, sir.
So, is this the PowerPoint?
It's the first slide, yes.
Okay. And what is this showing us?
Basically, it was put together just to give a quick demonstration on what can be done with physical evidence at a crime scene and some of the base requirements that are involved.
Okay. This says recording of imprint, impression evidence, seizure of item, photography, lifting methods, and enhancement. And that's sort of a guide about what we're about to see, correct?
Yes. It's also an outline of what could be done with physical evidence at a crime scene and then later on at the laboratory.
Okay. Next slide, please. Now, this says photographic evidence, enhanced photographs of the question imprint impression for use in comparison examination with known footwear outsoles or transparencies of known footwear outsoles. Well, explain that. What does that mean?
With all types of evidence, especially at a crime scene, as I mentioned before, photography is one of the keys, documenting the evidence in place. In many cases, you can't take the evidence back to a laboratory, so you have to rely on the photographic images. If they're taken with quality equipment, quality cameras, and in a proper format, a lot of work can be done with them. They can be associated to a known and a question. Photography is still the key for bringing the scene either into the laboratory or into the courtroom.
And are there certain, and we're going to see this in just a minute, certain requirements, I guess is the right word to use, on how those photographs are taken, depending on what you want to use them for?
Correct. There are different types of photography, just as we have portrait photography here, the media that's present. All of that is a form of documentation.
Okay. We'll talk about that in just a minute. And by the way, intercomparison examination with known footwear outsoles or transparencies of known footwear outsoles. What does that mean?
There's a difference between taking a picture of something and then taking a photograph for examination quality, where you do need the detail to find the individual characteristics that might be present for a comparison. And again, it would be a known, whatever the known object is, whether it's a shoe, a fingerprint, could be a tool mark, it could be any type of pattern, and the sample that's found at the scene, okay, or against the instrument that may have caused that mark. The more detailed the images, the better the quality of the examination, and the more reliable the showing of the detail and proportion. So the side-by-side comparison is your known and your question.
Okay, because most of these are basically eyeball examinations, either under a microscope or looking at it just with your naked eye, correct?
All of the above.
Right. Okay, next, please. Photographic techniques, FUS. Tell us what that means.
It's just an acronym to help the photographer remember to do certain things, especially when it comes to analytical photographs. You want to take whatever the image on a picture or inside the viewfinder of the camera, such as the gentleman has, and fill that entire image that captures the picture. You're maximizing the amount of detail that can be retained either in a digital format or a film format. The opposite would be taking a medium close-up where you show an overview, multiple items, or something as a wide-angle shot of the entire courtroom. So there's a whole series of photographs that go with this method. Secondly, using a scale. If it's going to be used for analysis, you want a known reference in there so that you can recreate the image later in a dark room or on a computer so that the image is now in life-size proportion. So again, if I have an article of footwear, I can place that or take a sample from it. That would be one-to-one or life-size. I can recreate the image, either take it from the crime scene or the standard, the photograph, using that scale to that same reference. I can also recreate that one-to-one so that I can get a size proportion right as part of the analysis. It would also be an elimination. If the sizes were different, it couldn't be from the same source. Side lighting is a lighting technique that's used. Right? When the photograph is taken, if it's an object of interest and if you're using it for analysis, you may want a side light coming in at different angles to show the different detail that might be there, especially in a three-dimensional picture. Two-dimensional, it helps, but it's not as critical. Right? And lastly, several shots. You want to take multiple exposures of each image. With digital photography today, it's a lot easier because the image pops up so you can see that you've captured it. In past technologies, you had a photograph on film and you couldn't see the result until you processed the film, which is usually long after you've left the scene or the incident. So there's several advantages to the newer technologies.
So this says special note, film plane must be level parallel to the imprint impression.
Yes, sir.
What does that mean?
The film plane is actually the back of the camera. It's where the image is actually captured. That film plane, if my object is here, would have to be here. I want those two images parallel. It avoids distortion and vignetting. Okay, the way the angles may come up. If you think of a tall building, right, and you look up at it, the building tends to come together. The same thing happens with angular photography. Okay, there's distortion that occurs, and even in close-up images, right? By using the scales and making sure that your film plane is parallel to the object that you're taking, right? You try to avoid that distortion as one of the considerations, and again, it would give you a more accurate rendering.
So when you take this photograph, you can compare it to a footprint, a fingerprint, a tire track.
Mm-hmm.
You want it, the photograph to be, the camera's lens to be parallel to that, so you're looking straight down at it.
Yes, sir.
That's one of the shots you should get, but that's the most important shot.
For analytical quality imaging, yes.
Right. You're not taking it to send home to mom. It's for analytical purposes, correct?
Yes, sir.
And then you have other shots from the side or whatever, and that helps you, if you see a detail, get more perspective on it, if you will.
It could, but it also shows the orientation to the surrounding area. And again, that three-shot sequence, close-up, medium close-up, and then an overview. You're telling a story through pictures.
So let me stop and sort of go off script for a second. You started with what police department and when?
City of New Haven.
And what was your role or job when you started?
Initially as a patrolman, doing patrol activities. Spent a year on the Corporation Council doing civil investigation. Unfortunately, I got hurt.
And how did you get hurt?
On a burglar on the premise call. I fell through a drywall and ended up destroying my left knee.
Okay, and so you had to leave the police department after that?
No. Well, no. It was about 9 years later.
Okay, so did you continue to be a patrolman after hurting
your
knee?
No, I was promoted and went into the identification unit after leaving the Corporation Council. And was performing crime scene related activities, basic investigation.
So again, so when you first started, I mean, you were a detective at that point?
When I first started as a patrol officer, was promoted to detective.
Okay, and when you're doing crime, responding to murder scenes or house breakings or whatever.
Yes, sir.
You were a detective at that point?
Plainclothes officer or detective, okay. Yes.
So when you responded to the scene, did you take a camera?
Yes, sir, always.
Okay, and did you follow FUS?
Yes, sir.
And so, I mean, this was required by procedure and policy at your department, correct?
Yes, and also the teaching in the specialized schools that I had been to.
Okay. And you started that in the 80s?
In the 70s.
70s, I'm sorry. So this is what you've done while you were a police officer for a span of decades, correct?
Yes, sir.
Starting
I've also
in the
taught it.
Starting in the 70s?
Yes, sir.
So this isn't some newfound procedure. This is something you've done for 4 decades?
Correct.
Okay. Next, please. So this is use of a tripod when photographing evidence with detail. A tripod must be used.
It's recommended. It makes it more stable. You don't have to worry about even the pulse in your fingers. And depending on the length of the exposure that's necessary, causing any vibration or defocusing that might occur.
And this is a process or procedure, and this shows a guy shooting out in front, not straight down. That would be incorrect?
For a documentation or an analytical photograph, yes.
Okay.
What happens is his camera's at an angle. He's doing a flat object here. And again, the distortion effects that I explained earlier.
Okay. And this is also a procedure you followed for decades?
Yes, sir.
And is it a procedure you taught when you taught police officers?
Yes, sir.
And is it a procedure you heard about when you attended classes?
Yes, sir.
Okay, next, please. And what does this depict?
Here we have two examples of the position of a camera. Right? They're line drawings on a tripod showing the proper orientation to an object being photographed. Right? The film plane, even if the item is on an angle, the camera and the lens would also be on that same angle. Right? Again, to avoid distortion.
So you ought to have a tripod, and the lens ought to be parallel to whatever it's shooting at.
It makes it easier to have the tripod, yes.
Right. Next. Is this demonstration the same thing?
It's a demonstration showing what happens when you don't do that. If you look at the object on the bottom, the black dots, you'll notice that they're distorted, right? They're not in proper proportion, and there's some angularity to them.
Okay, next. Okay, now, tell us what these photographs are of. Where did these come from?
These are images that I took at a homicide scene in the state of New York. Right. Essentially, we were asked to come and assist, mutual aid, similar to the different agencies here helping one another. By going to New York, we had certain things that maybe their laboratory or their crime scene unit didn't have access to.
Tell me what the difference is.
Well, the two photographs show a kitchen area. On the right-hand side, you have what looks like a kitchen, right, a sink. And if you look directly down on the floor, there's kind of a reddish stain that you can barely see. By using various chemical processing methods, as well as photo documentation, right, the picture on the left, I was able to bring up a lot more footprints that were occult or latent. They were kind of invisible, just in very light blood residue. And the screening test that we use to try to develop those, right, reacts with the proteins that are in blood and causes a color change so that now they're more visible, even if you couldn't see that area in the beginning, right? Similar to a latent print that's invisible when you touch the surface.
And what's a latent print?
It could be a footprint, it could be a fingerprint, but it's whatever residue is there that's left on a surface that you can't normally see without some type of enhancement.
Okay, and so you participated in putting the chemical on the floor here?
I put the chemical on the floor.
And what was it?
It was ortho-otylidine.
Say that again?
Ortho-otylidine.
Okay. And what year was this? Approximately.
Mid-80s?
In the 80s. So this is not some newfound chemical. It's been around,
sir,
for 40 years. Okay. And this is what y'all were doing in the 80s?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And so did you just spray it on the floor? How do you apply it to the floor?
It's sprayed with an aerosol, very similar to misting from a deodorant can or hairspray.
Okay. And how long does it take to raise these previously invisible footprints?
Almost instantaneous.
And so once those are raised, what's the next step?
If we go to the next slide.
Next slide.
Basically setting up the tripod, the camera, right, to do photo documentation. The other option is literally to cut the sections out of the floor or counter or whatever the imprint or impressions are and take that with you.
Did you just take photographs or did you cut up the floor?
We relied on photographs in this case.
Okay. And this is a tripod we see, so you're shooting straight down on the image?
Yes, sir.
Okay, next. And what is that?
That's an example of what the footprint actually looked like after enhancement. Any of the bluish, greenish areas were not visible right in the beginning.
So wherever you see blue or green here, you couldn't see that on the print, on the floor, but once you did this, what had previously been invisible was now visible.
Correct.
Okay.
Photographs would have been taken before the spray and then after.
Next. And what is this?
Again, it's an example of a partial footprint or two. In this case, it's actually on plywood, and it appears to be in a blood-like substance. The next. Scale is there just for size
right.
and measurement.
The scale is important. Right. Next. What is that?
This is after enhancement, okay, after applying the same chemical.
Go back. Forward. So, again, you applied that same, what was the name of that chemical?
Ortho-otylidine.
We've heard some testimony about something called LCV. Is that the same thing or similar?
It's similar. It's a protein dye stain, and there's several others.
And would it raise, if you sprayed it like this and took, would it raise the
it
imprint?
Could.
Would it do the same thing?
Quite possibly. Each one of the reagents has a sensitivity level. Some are more sensitive than others.
And you don't use LCV?
We've used LCV. We've used amido black. We've used phenolphthalein. Right. Okay. So there's any number of options, and a lot of it has to do with the color. You want to have something different than the background color so that you have contrast. And that's the other part about photography. You need contrast to see something.
So like LCV, I think, turns things
purplish.
Purple. So if you have dark background, you would not want to use LCV.
Most probably, yes.
Okay. Next. Is that it? Okay. What time is it? Your Honor, it's 4 minutes till one. This might be a good time to break.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, we will recess until 2:15. Please do not discuss the case.
That wraps up our second segment of coverage in the trial of Alec Murdaugh. There is more to come. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of the breaking updates and discussions and courtroom coverage that we have for you right here. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.